Hi, I'm Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, a foot and ankle surgeon and assistant professor at Boston University Medical Center.
Hi, I'm Katrina Sanders. I'm a registered dental hygienist, consultant, international speaker, and wine lover.
And we're sisters. I grew up looking up to my big sister, Katrina.
And now I look up to my lady boss, physician sister, Elizabeth.
Together, we are working to unite the dental and medical communities in unique and exciting ways.
Welcome to Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters, our monthly podcast,
where we unpack all things health related from your mouth to your toes.
So grab your flossy flops
and slide on some flippy floppies
and let's get on with the show. All right. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Floss and Flip Flops with your favorite ginger sisters, the Sanders Sisters. Hello, Dr. Sanders. How are you today? Are you good?
I'm so good. How are you, Katrina? It's so good to see you.
Ah, thank you. It's good to be seen. I feel like we just spent like an insane amount of time together and now we're like back to opposite sides of the country.
We spent time on the top of a mountain together.
Well, actually not a lot of time on the top of the mountain because I don't know if you remember, but by the time I got to the top of the mountain, I was like, great, we did it. Let's go.
And you took a nap immediately when you got down. But it was so great. We spent 5 days together. Yes. No cell phones, no power, nothing. But it was an amazing experience. And I can't believe that was actually about a month ago.
I know. It's crazy. So mm-hmm. for those of you listening, Elizabeth is referring to is our climb on Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This is, the African Continental Summit. So it certainly is a summit that a lot of climbers attempt. And by attempt, I of course mean there are many climbers that do not make it to the top. We were amongst those that walked away with certificates, with our ages on it, by the way, like how weird. They give you a certificate like Katrina Sanders, age 37. I'm like, really? Like we have to announce that. Okay. But we made it up and down, which was just a wonderful experience.
I'm telling you, on summit day, it was a questionable whether we would make it, but we did it together. Amazing experience.
Speaking of did it together and amazing experience, I'm so excited for today's episode.
Me too.
This episode it's kind of interesting. We actually did a little bit of a course correction because last month we had Dr. Thomas Lee with his Hands on Africa.
Gosh, is he amazing?
He's just so inspiring and so involved, and his heart is just like so engaged in how he can use his skills, his, you know, God-given talents to be able to serve and support. And so we had it was a very popular episode. We had a lot of amazing feedback from it. People like sliding into my DMs, like, this is amazing. I want to learn more. And so I thought, you and I together thought our audience would eat this next episode up. So today, we are going to be introducing Dr. Kimberly Harms to the podcast. I'm going to try to not get like emotional and cry as I share the story about why it is so important that she's here and why it is that we hear her message. So,
well, Katrina, I first met Dr. Harms over a Zoom as well, because you introduced me to her. Mm-hmm. And you told me the story about how you met her. I really want to hear, first off, how did you meet Dr. Harms and what was your association with her at the time?
Okay, so I'll give a short backstory. Ever since I was a youth, like middle school, high school, and I had learned about the genocide that occurred in Rwanda, I've been fascinated by Rwanda. And I think most people learned about the genocide from the Don Cheadle movie, Hotel Rwanda. Mm. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's wildly accurate about what happened. I definitely want Dr. Harms to walk us through what happened during that genocide. But I was fascinated by it. And more so what Rwanda was doing to rebuild after it. And so I'd always kind of had that in the back of my brain. And I showed up to a dental conference and there was a dentist there, Dr. Kim Harms, who was going to be presenting on doing humanitarian work. And that was kind of, it was, wasn't it, Kim? Wasn't it just kind of like it was kind of broad, right? Like you didn't say like Rwanda is, right?
Right. It was about getting through tumultuous times. And it was just right through, you know, we were going through the pandemic and all kinds of things. So it was tumultuous times in general, but certainly I used Rwanda. I had a little separate 10-minute time where I talked specifically about Rwanda, trying to visit there and get connected with the dental program there. But the bigger piece was about getting through tumultuous and difficult times. And of course, they are the best example, I think, ever of a country not only surviving, but thriving after like the worst that can happen, the worst that could happen happened to them. And they are now not just surviving, but thriving in the aftermath.
Love that.
You know, I think it's, yes. And I want to talk about that. Well, so the first time that I heard you speak was in 2019.
Could have been. Yep.
And mom had just died. Mm-hmm. And so you start telling the story. So this was, cause I've seen you now speak twice. So you start telling the story, start unpacking the story about what happened in Rwanda during the genocide and about how inspirational it is that through all of this heart-wrenching pain and destruction that happened in this country, that there's beauty, there's humanity in this somewhere. And so I'm heartbroken. Mom had passed about 2.5 months prior to that. And I wrote a note to myself that said, note to self, in 5 years, go to Rwanda with Kim Harms. I wrote that.
You didn't tell me then though. I would have hounded you.
I know. Well, I was just sitting there quietly, which I think is an important testament to you that there are probably a bajillion people that hear you speak about this or will hear this podcast and will think in their mind, at some point, I want to do this. I'm going to do it. Right. But you haven't interacted with them. Do you know what I mean? Right. So just know that there are people out there, or if you're that person right now listening, like I hear you because I was there. So fast forward, now it's January of 21 and dad had died 3 weeks prior and Kim is speaking again, same deal. And I'm like, okay, I'm done writing that someday I'm going to do things. Something happens when you lose two parents over the span of 2 years and you realize that tomorrow is not promised. You recognize that legacy is critical, that someday may not ever happen. And so you have to start taking control. And so I just knew in that moment that I needed to talk to you. So here's what I want to do before we really get into us talking. Will you walk us through what happened in Rwanda in 1994 that really has created such a deep-rooted focus on the Rwandan Republic?
Sure. So in 1994, in Rwanda, the majority population, which were the Hutu population, were involved in a genocide in which they were trying to wipe out the minority population, which are the Tutsis. It was a genocide that was led by extremists, and they had been preparing this years in advance. They had spent a lot of time on the radio, downgrading the Tutsis, calling them cockroaches, saying that they're bad. And when a trigger happened, which was the death of their president. The president of Rwanda and Burundi were flying out of the airport. Somebody shot him down. Nobody to this day knows for sure who it was, but that was a trigger for this genocide to occur. And the Hutus, who had been practicing militia training with machetes for this event, all came out, became active, and went after the Tutsi population. If you watch the movie Hotel Rwanda. It's a pretty good description of what happened. This was planned years in advance. It started when the two populations were kind of separated during the colonial time with the Belgians. The Tutsis were considered more intelligent by the Belgians because of head size or color or whatever. And then the Hutus were kind of downgraded. And so for a certain percentage of time, the Tutsis kind of had more privilege. Then in 1964, when they gained their independence, the majority population, which were the Hutus, kind of came over, and then that resentment that was carried over from years ago kind of blossomed and became bigger. And there were a number of little mini genocides that would occur, but it was kind of all from that, basically the difference between a privileged population and an unprivileged population, which can occur anywhere in the world. You know, if you look back in Armenia, and if you look back on Germany and other places where genocides have occurred, it's basically that sort of conflict between the haves and the have-nots, kind of, and this spurred on, you know, by some evil person, somebody that wants to see this happen. Same thing happened in Rwanda, same kind of causes as in other genocides. But they lost from 800,000 to 1 million people in 3 months, 100 days, which was the largest mass killing per day in the history of the world. I mean, they were very, very efficient. They had planned for this. They had trained for this. And it was just a horrific, I can't even talk about it now without just wanting to cry. It was a horrific, horrific thing. And then some Tutsi groups that was up in Uganda kind of came down and with an army and stopped the genocide. And what they did, though, which I think is very important to their recovery, was when this was over, what they did is they punished the perpetrators. They did not give amnesty to the people that did the killing, even though they were all killing together. They didn't give them amnesty. They punished the perpetrators. They put them in jail for about 20 years. And then as this was happening, they focused on forgiveness, which how can you even, I mean, it's hard for the brain to comprehend forgiveness for such a horrible atrocity, because they were murdered brutally. They were murdered, raped. Children were killed brutally as you could even imagine. But forgiveness was their focus, and reconciliation. They said, okay, they're going to get punished. We're going to bring it back in society one day, and we're going to have to get along. And many people that you talk to in Rwanda say they did this because they did not want their children to suffer the same fate they had suffered. They knew that if they allowed that hatred to continue, that their children would be on one side or the other, and that hatred would go on for generation to generation. So they were able to really stop this, because you don't see that conflict anymore. In fact, you can't say you're Hutu or Tutsi in Rwanda. You're just Rwandan, which I think as Americans, we might want to learn something from that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just the most amazing. Their recovery was just absolutely amazing.
You know, I think that's just, thank you so much for walking us through that. That's amazing. The piece that I think is so important in looking at all of what Rwanda experienced in 1994 was that this was neighbor on neighbor killing. These were children hiding in closets and watching as their parents were slaughtered while their mother was raped, older sister was raped. Mm-hmm. The amount of killings that happened over that spectrum of time has completely changed that country in so many ways. And, you know, it's interesting. When we were in Rwanda, it took me a few days of being there and driving through the small towns there, where I thought to myself, I'm seeing young children getting excited because a car's driving by, and they're not used to seeing cars drive by in some of these small towns. And so they want to wave to the cars, the Americans driving by. It was like a parade, right? Mm-hmm. But I thought to myself, where are the elderly? Like, where are the old people? And the reality is they were slaughtered in the killings. The average age, I believe, of an individual in Rwanda is what, 32?
It's very young, under 35.
Very young. 60% of their political leadership is female. Mm-hmm. And so it's very interesting part of the killings that happened is the Hutu wanted to cripple the Tutsi in any way they could. And that meant killing, you know, individuals in a leadership, in power. That meant killing anybody who was educated, doctors, dentists, attorneys. You know, think about the people who at the end of the day are going to push and move a society forward. So they killed educated individuals. They burnt schools. They burnt libraries to the ground as a means of making it difficult for the Tutsi population to gather, to collaborate, and to make it difficult for them to rebuild. But one piece that is so incredible that you touch on is the forgiveness. And there are incredible stories of you know, families, Tutsi families that adopted a Hutu soldier after, you know, after the dust had settled, so to speak, because of forgiveness. Family for them is more than we are blood relatives. Family for them is, you know, whoever we have left, we come together as a community and we rebuild. Which I think is just such a beautiful, beautiful lesson in all of this. For those of you listening who do work in the healthcare space, of course, you're thinking what we're all thinking, which is you now have a society. So this is now July of 94 is when we saw, it wasn't a full resolution. Many of the mass killings stopped, but there still were a lot of issues at that time. But then there was an aftermath. And that aftermath was, there were bodies everywhere. The aftermath was, children were orphaned, that babies, didn't have their mother to breastfeed. It was, people were injured, you know, disfigured from what happened. And, one piece that I think just really like ripped my heart out and threw it on the floor when I was at the genocide memorial was, women were raped by men who knew that they were HIV positive. And so the HIV and AIDS epidemic, as it was observed in Africa around that time, HIV was like biological warfare in a way. Mm-hmm. And so now here we are, you know, doctors, nurses, dentists, you know, anybody in this space, they can't help. And the community had to come together and find a way to rebuild. So I thank you so much for sharing that story about the genocide. I think it's an important one. And so I heard Kim speak once. Now, remember, mom had just passed. And now, Kim, you're telling me this, you know, telling everybody in this conference hall, this beautiful story. And then dad passes. And I'm like, okay, I get it. Because dad passes, Kim's telling the story again about tumultuous times and about the importance of coming together as a community, and family means something different, and legacy, and all of these incredible things. And so I walked right up to you. You probably had no idea who it was.
Did you? Oh, yeah. Okay. Really? Can anyone in a room not know who Katrina is? I mean, come on.
You're so funny. Well, I walk up
to you. You kind of stick out, Katrina.
So I walk up to Kim and I'm like, I have to come with you to Rwanda. Like, I have to come. Like, next time you're going, I have to come. And
when Katrina says she's doing something, she's doing, something.
And so that really is where our story kind of unfolds. So would you mind, Kim, walking our listeners through what it is that I listened to, what you shared about what brought you to Rwanda, because this is an amplification of so much. It's about inspiration. It's about the human spirit. It's about heartbreak. It's about mental health. It is a story of so many things. So will you walk us through what got you to Rwanda, which, by the way, is eventually what brought the Sanders sisters to Rwanda?
Well, for me, the big overreaching answer is divine intervention through all of this, because I look at the timing and look at where we were and what we're doing. I think a lot of divine intervention was going on. But what brought me to when Rwanda happened, I was a mother with small children and busy with my life and thinking, oh, this is horrible. You know, how could this happen? But that was about it. I hadn't really gotten into that because my life was busy with other things, a practice. I was a practicing dentist full time. And so, but about in 2009, I lost my beautiful son, Eric, to suicide. And I had lost my mother to suicide. So this was, a horrible time in my life. In fact, my life just stopped. I mean, my heart splintered into a million pieces. You know how that goes. I didn't know how I was going to survive. I had to, I was just trying to get myself back. I had two daughters that still needed me. They were adults, but they were struggling too. My husband had just had a liver transplant. He had liver cancer, just lost my brother. It was just a horrific time in my life. And I didn't know how I was going to survive, very literally. But what happened was all of a sudden Rwanda started hitting me out of the blue. I was sitting at a prayer breakfast and I sat next to someone who had, who was telling me about her family. She was from Rwanda, first person I ever met from Rwanda. And she told me how she had lost her two daughters and her husband in the genocide, how her children were at a school. They tried to meet her husband at night because they knew they were after both of them. And found out the next day that the entire school, all the girls in it was a girls' school, all the girls in the school had been murdered. And her husband also had been murdered and she was alone. And she was able to survive the genocide. And then she was talking about her new family. She had remarried and she had adopted children. And I thought, wow, how could she serve? I lost one child, and she's lost so much in her life. All of her goods were burned.
Everything.
Everything. Yeah. They burned everything. So she had nothing. And here she is. Here she is. And she's talking and smiling. And she's like, how can, when you go through a catastrophic loss, you don't think you're ever going to have a real smile. You kind of have the fake smile, but you don't really have a real smile. You have a fake smile. How could she do this? She seemed genuinely like she could have joy in her life. How did this happen? I couldn't believe it. And then somehow, and I don't even remember how this happened. I came along, I guess I do know, a friend of mine had a Books on Tape of Immaculée Ely Benghazi, who's an author. She wrote a book called Left to Tell. And it's a story about how she, during the genocide, was able to survive when her entire family was wiped out by hiding in a bathroom with like seven or eight other women in a bathtub and trying to survive when the killers were coming after her. She could hear them calling her name outside this home of a pastor who was able to kind of shove a closet or something up so that they were hoping that when they came to investigate, they wouldn't see the door to the bathroom. So she was hidden in just a miraculous way, saved in a miraculous way in a bathroom. And then my heart really started reaching out for Rwanda because I started thinking, okay, here she is talking now. And I was able to see her, she does a book tour. She's talking now and she has another family. She has life. She can laugh from the heart. How could she do this? Here's two people now I've met or I've seen or I've heard of from Rwanda. How does this happen? And then wouldn't you know it, the next week or so, I was sitting down with my dear friend, Pam, who was on the board of Books for Africa. And she had been to Rwanda before the genocide. And we were talking and she said, Kim, wouldn't it be wonderful if we did a memorial library for Eric? Because Eric was at Columbia. He was a Latin lover. He loved Latin. He loved anything classic. He loved books. He would save books from the library because he couldn't stand to see books thrown out. He would go and collect all the old classic books, that they were kind of tossing. And so he loved books. And he was this lovely, kind, caring, compassionate person. And she said, wouldn't it be a wonderful memorial to him to have a library in Rwanda? I said, oh gosh, yes, of course. So we got together and we raised the money to send a shipment of books to Rwanda. And we were able to start with seven libraries there. And of course I talked to the dental school. They were not training. They weren't even in training. The dental surgeons weren't in training yet. They had dental therapists there that really were doing most of the work around the country. So I was able to connect. I met one of them that first time you met Fabrice.
I met him as
a student there. He's just little
guy.
I met him the first time as a student back in the dental school. So I made some long-term friends. And when I went there, you were telling the story about how the people forgave each other. I was able to, our host was Father Remy, who had just lost his father, his stepfather. He had lost his parents in the genocide, and he and his brother survived by hiding in a woodshed. He also lost his sister. And he was showing me around, and he talked to, his father had died, but it was his uncle actually, because his aunt and uncle had adopted him.
Yes.
They had lost five of their children in the genocide, and they thought they lost their grandchild. But what happened is when their son and daughter-in-law were getting ready to be killed, you know, because they were all being killed, they made a deal with the killers and said, look, I can find you some more money, but you have to promise not to kill the baby. And they said, okay. So he went and found more money, gave them money, and they killed the parents and took the baby. And the baby was raised by Hutu family. And 14 years later in jail, they had just discovered that by someone confessed and said, no, we didn't. We killed those two, but we didn't kill the baby. She's with his family. So they were able
I'm sorry to interrupt this.
I know.
This is crazy. So for everybody listening, here's what happened. When the Hutus went to prison, they could reduce their prison sentence, right? By creating some confessions around, yes, we did kill this. Yes, we did. And remember, this
and
is
serving
like,
the community.
And serving the community. Mm-hmm. But this is like neighbor on neighbor. Like, think about that. I mean, this is like, Elizabeth and I grew up in a small town in the Midwest. Like, so Hutus would like call out their Tutsi neighbors, they're hiding here or whatever. They would lure them to churches. They lured them to the volcanoes. I mean, it's insane what happened. So these Hutu that were now being charged and tried for their crimes could say, they could start to create those connections. And so how in 14 years later, these people find out, my brother and his wife were killed, but the baby was saved. And where is this baby? And so now families are being reunited through this forgiveness process.
And it's complicated because she was raised by a family she loved, a very poor family.
Yes.
And now she has another family. So she was sharing, because I went there, it was 16, 17 years later. So she was just reconnecting with her family. And just an amazing thing. And at that time, it wasn't, the 20 years wasn't up. Most of this prison sentences are 20 years old. When you drive up north, you would drive up and you would see the prisoners they grow their own food. So they'd be out on work detail to grow their own food. And there'd be 20, 30, 40 prisoners all lined up in pink jumpsuits along the road, walking back to the prison. There'd be one guard in the front with a rifle, one guard in the back with a rifle. And all these prisoners had hoes and sickles and machetes and all the things they used.
Oh.
During the genocide, and there were like two guards. And I asked Father Remy, I said, well, wait a minute, this is, how can they do that? There's not enough to protect them. And he said, well, they have nowhere to go. Their families would send them back to prison.
Wow.
So they're not going to kill the guards. They have nowhere to go. And what a shock to my brain that that's what would happen. They all just, I did this. This is my punishment. And I have so many more years. So I'm going to accept this and do what I have to do.
How amazing. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. That was very common.
Yeah. Well, and it's amazing to see now because, although we can more openly share some of these stories over the podcast today, the genocide is not something that is talked about in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. In the time that we were there, like Moses was our driver, like shout out to Moses, love him. He's amazing. he dealt with a lot of my bologna sausage, but he was awesome. Gilbert was another one of our drivers. Like the people that we are interacting with who are, they're millennials. They are younger. They are the ones that had to carry this country forward and, through healing and all of that. They all lived through the genocide.
That's right. If you think about how old you were, or I was.
Yeah, 1994. I was in fourth grade. Yeah,
exactly. And these are the people who are now adults. And now they're without parents and they're living on and the community. Yeah. And we'll talk about this even later, how amazing the community is now.
Yeah. And to your point, Elizabeth, and you're absolutely right. As they have now aged, it's this piece that they all remember. They all know it's a part of their history. Mm-hmm. But what's so beautiful about it is that this tragedy is something that the country of Rwanda has been able to use to really create beauty, to create humanity from, to inspire forgiveness. You know, we in the United States, we think that we're such a developed country, but I will say it was incredible being in Rwanda and thinking they are light years ahead of where we are in all of this. You know, it's really incredible. So the, you know, Moses, Gilbert, our drivers, like they lived through the genocide. And the thing is, I don't know if they are Tutsi, Hutu. You don't know if they were the ones that did the killings or they were the ones that lost family. But they, I mean, everybody lost, everybody experienced loss. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing. I was there, I presented a program with Elizabeth at the medical school. And then the three of us presented for Dr. Lee with the dental conference. And I remember at the medical school, I shared about how important, airway issues are and things like that. And how important it is for the dental profession, medical profession, to find that deep-rooted sense of responsibility in serving others. And I share the story about how mom passed and the fact that it was preventable. And if a really great provider had seen her and cared, she might still be alive today. And I'll never forget when I shared mom's story, there was an audible gasp in the room from the medical students that were sitting there in that room. And I almost felt silly, like sharing my like trauma of like my mom who was 62, who died, you know, because it's like they all experienced like, I mean, just unbelievable loss. And yet it was like there was no compassion fatigue. It was just, it was because they knew, because they understood what that loss felt like, it meant more for them. And so as medical providers, as dental providers, it was like, it was more than just fine tuning your psychomotor skills or fine tuning your clinical decision-making modalities. It was about, we are all human. And how can I take what I know about this experience or what these people are experiencing in their lives? And how can I, as a provider, create a deeper rooted sense of responsibility around that, which I absolutely love. So Kim, I interrupted your story. So you go to Rwanda, you and Pam go, right? Mm-hmm. Books for Africa. And tell me about what Books for Africa, what the Eric J. Harms Memorial Library Foundation, like tell us all about what that experience was like.
Well, the foundation is great because it really isn't a foundation. It all goes through Books for Africa. So I don't have to handle any money or anything. We went to Rwanda and we had the Books for Africa is the largest shipper of books to Africa. They've shipped to every single country, 55 million books. I forget, I lose track.
Oh,
they
my
ship
gosh.
Books. It's just amazing. An amazing organization. They're so well run. Every penny gets used to ship books. They get lots of donation of books that are located in their a great big warehouse in Atlanta. There's a warehouse here in Minneapolis. And they get shipped out in containers. It's probably around $10,000, $12,000 to ship a container of 20,000 books. So it's 50 cents a book or so to ship a container to an African country with a port. Unfortunately, Rwanda does not have a port. And so it costs maybe $15,000 to $20,000 because of a lot of other expenses to get it back into the country. So it's almost double to get into the country. What we did with Pam, and they have also Thomson Reuters, which is a law firm. They do a lot. They are a publishing company for many, many law books. Both my daughters are attorneys, and they have a program. It's called it's a law and justice program that was founded by Kofi Annan and Walter Mondale. So they have some pretty big hitters there, where they developed a list of books. It's specifically designed for emerging countries in Africa. So it's a list of law books specifically designed for these countries. And Thomson Reuters partners with Books for Africa. So we were able to send, we now have about over 50 libraries, over 300,000 books right now have been sent. And we have, we visit our third law library there. So three of those were from Thomson Reuters. It's a complete law library. And we also sent books to the dental school, and back before the laws changed, it's harder to ship computers now, but we shipped a whole law, a library, of a computer library when Fabrice was starting out and so on. We had a big computer library, sent out their 20, 30 computers, which really helped them move along because of virtual learning. It is, of course, humongous. You know, it's such a huge offering in areas where you can't get live learning. You know, you just send the virtual learning. So, and then we have, we also have a partnership with Merck, with the Merck manual. So we were able to bring a lot of Merck manuals on e-readers out this time. And we've sent probably well over 1,000, 2,000 Merck manuals to physicians and nurses all over the country. And much of the healthcare is done by nurses out in the boonies, out in the hinterlands. And a Merck manual is so helpful for them because, you know, they don't know what to do. They kind of look it up, you know, in the Merck manual. So we've been able to do that. We have lots of small nursery school libraries.
Kim, do you think instead of saying, oh, we should just Google it, they just say, let's just Merck it.
Yeah, actually, they don't always, you know, they don't always have
for sure. Computers.
I know it's crazy.
But we didn't have Wi-Fi half the time we were there. Yeah. Fun fact, I lost my phone, as everybody on this recording knows. I lost my phone somewhere in Belgium, and I'm messaging with Dr. Lee, and I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'll just go to an Apple store in Rwanda. And he's just like, you don't even know what you're talking about. There's no Apple store here. So, and I don't mean to laugh about it, but it's just the things that we think here in a developed country, or for those of our colleagues who are listening in Canada, you know, in developed countries where we have access to anything we want. Right. I mean, it's amazing. And so the work that you are doing, and we have to remember, after the genocide happened, this is an underdeveloped country that now has had all of their resources completely wiped out. Yes. And they are in destruction. I mean, the people people are sick, people are injured, people are, you know, dead, dying. There's no infrastructure, no buildings, no books, nobody to help. And yes, they did have some relief systems, and you know, there were wonderful initiatives that happened to help support in some ways. But what I love about what you're doing with the books is you are creating sustainability, right? Those books give future upon generation upon, you know, all of these pieces that we're starting to see that are getting built out now, they will be able to interact with these books, and they will be able to continue to further their education.
Mm-hmm. That's so amazing. And Katrina, you talked about how, you know, their whole country was broken apart with it, and yet they're rebuilding at this time. And you could say easily that they're, compared to the United States, they're just not at our level. But I would say in other ways too, they're even more built up, especially with their sense of community. When you go to Rwanda and you drive around, it is the cleanest city you will ever go to, because they have a community day. It's once a month, Saturdays, where they go around and they clean the whole area. You will not see litter on the ground. They have a really deep appreciation for their entire country and for community. And that's something, I think their humbleness and their sense of community and being able to talk to them, they have a deep appreciation for people in general. You know, when we would clean their teeth and we would introduce ourselves to the little children, Katrina, weren't they the most polite children?
They were so polite. I know, it was amazing.
You ask, what is your name? And they say, in English, by the way, my name is, and then they say their name. And unfortunately, I can't repeat their name back to them. But, and then after we did their dental cleaning, they were the most appreciative children, and they never complained. It was unbelievable. And they were so appreciative of our care. And I think they're very appreciative of the books as well. When they found out about the library that we were bringing, and we'll talk more about it, they were so appreciative. So Dr. Harms, I think what you're doing is unbelievable, and it really warms our heart.
Well, the thing about Rwanda that I absolutely, because you, when you go there, once I knew you guys would get hooked on this. It was my ultimate plan. But once you get there, you can't get it out of your system.
No.
And the reason is they will take, sometimes you go and you help a community or something and you go there and you do your work and you leave and, you know, that's it. But they will take whatever you give them and they will build upon it and they will appreciate it. And when you come back, because I've been doing this over 10 years, so I come back and there's, you know, something new that they've used the little bit of resources that you've given them and they've made it into something better. And that really is the key. Again, something we could learn. I think everyone should take a mandatory trip to Rwanda, just tour the country, because they learned that. There's a group, you mentioned the AIDS situation. There's a group of wonderful, beautiful young women, or they're older women, they're genocide survivors that were raped by the perpetrators. And some of them had children by the people that had killed their families. You can imagine the trauma.
Oh my God.
And they work together. So the women form these collectives and they work together and they run a sewing business. So they all work together and they've made a new family because they've kind of been, because they have AIDS and because they had children out of wedlock by the perpetrators, they feel isolated. And so they form their own group and they're being treated for AIDS. So they're you know, living as healthy a life as they can with AIDS. And they have made their own family and they've made their own business. They're doing sewing. So I could probably, if there are people interested in working with those young women who are just the most amazing women in the world, again, they are laughing and they're having a good time. And I go there and say, how can you've not only lost your family, but now you have a child that you're going to raise. It was fathered by your rapist and you're isolated from your community. How can you laugh and smile? How can you have joy back in your life? Those are the lessons you learn that are just, you just, again, can't get it out of your system. They're just amazing people.
That is so beautiful. And you actually spoke to them, didn't you?
I work with them. We had a meeting with them and I was there, about 5 or 6 years ago, and I work with, there's another group. I think the one you're referring to is a group of villagers who, right after the genocide, the widows were widowed because their husbands were killed, and the widows that were widowed because their husbands were in jail for killing the other husbands. And they, a priest at one of the villages had started a support group for the widows of the actual widows whose husbands were killed. And the other women said, well, wait, what about us? Because in that traditional culture before the genocide, the men supported the family and the women as a widow had nothing. So they said, well, what about us? We're also suffering. And the very smart priest said, you know, I'll help you, but I'm not going to help you separately. We're going to help you together. So they talked about, I was with these women. It was just the most amazing experience. And they welcomed me because I had lost a child, just like they welcomed you because you'd lost someone. When they know you've suffered that loss, they will just, you're one of them. So and they talked about how the first meeting they sat on opposite sides and they didn't really talk to each other, but by about the fifth or sixth meeting, they started to realize that they had a lot more in common than they had to divide them. And they now became a cooperative and they work together and they support each other. And some of the Hutu women helped the Tutsi women join their families and kind of adopt their kids, not fully, but, you know, they kind of brought them into the family. And again, that family was the cooperative. It was no longer the small family unit. It was a cooperative. So the women that had just lost everything were able to be, were brought in and loved by the families of the perpetrators. I mean, just stories that are just unbelievable. But I was able to sit in that group with Father Remy as an interpreter. It was pretty amazing.
What you said just like literally ran chills up and down my spine. You said they found that they had more things in common than things that divided them, which again, when you think about, we had the opportunity to go to the genocide memorial in Kigali. There are many genocide memorials. Mm-hmm. They believe that there are about 250,000 individuals buried in the mass grave outside of the genocide memorial in Kigali. And it, you know, the entire experience, it walks you through what happened leading up to it, everything that you went over early on in this episode. And yet we continue to forget and yet remember in all this, that this was neighbor on neighbor hatred. This was a country attacking itself. And yet through all of this as the dust settles, and there is a result to all of this. People did give birth to children that were sired by the enemy, and they are HIV positive, and they have AIDS, and they are still building, libraries in these people's names. When we were in the volcanoes, you still saw small pieces of fabric from the clothing of the individuals who were slaughtered and killed in the volcanoes. I mean, it is still there. The history is there, and it is rich and it is robust. And yet Rwanda found a way to find the commonality in all of that. And I think that's just so important for me as a provider. How often is it an us versus them, hygienist versus dentist, or provider versus patient, or, competitor versus competitor, or whatever it may be. And yet it's so inspirational for us to see what happens when we find those commonalities. So I want to wrap up. Elizabeth, would you walk us through what happened when we went to the school in Karanj, what that was and what that experience was like?
Yeah, so first of all, we mainly came to Rwanda because of our connection with Dr. Harms, and then we were able to meet Dr. Lee, and it was just a phenomenal experience. And thankfully, Dr. Harms and her foundation were able to find us an amazing school, a Catholic school. And is that how you pronounce it? Karanj? Yeah, Karanj. Mm-hmm. And it was about an hour and a half drive out of where we were staying in Kigali. We went there to dedicate our library. Our library is the Bob and Linda Sanders Memorial Library. The books had already been sent there. So we were on our way. We thought, oh, it would be great. We'll just go there. It'll be a nice dedication. We'll see the books. We'll see them on the shelves. We'll meet the headmaster of the school and we'll take some pictures and then we'll be on our way. So here we are in a
famous
van.
Last words.
So we're in a van. Moses is driving us and we're all dressed up and we're on our way. Of course, driving through the hills, we're going up the mountains, again, seeing all the people in the community coming and waving to us. And as we get there, we see the whole school lined up. And well, we thought it was the whole school, right? And they're all lined up and they direct Dr. Harms, you, me, and we all go and we sit down and they start a little ceremony. So they start by singing to us, and they also have on the side a little, some people playing some drums, and they do an amazing dance. And then even more people came out. So it was probably about 200-300 people or so, children, who were putting on a great performance. They even let us come out and dance. It was just a beautiful, beautiful ceremony. And we did not expect it at all. They were just very appreciative of the library that we were dedicating. So we went and we were able to see all the books, and the books were all laid out and they looked beautiful. So thank you, Dr. Harms. They were all out there. And what they did is they asked us, they said, this is great. The books are all here, but they're in a classroom and we really do need a separate building for our books to be housed. So they did ask us for the funds to try to create an actual building that would be outside of a classroom. And we did agree to try to fund this new library, which we're very honored to be doing, because, again, these children are just so supportive and so appreciative of the books that we're giving them. They also did ask for certain books, especially like math books. And again, these children know, and they mainly spoke French where we went to the school, but they also do speak, some of them do speak English as well as their own language. And we're just honored to be a part of this project with the Bob and Linda Memorial Library. It was a very humbling experience, and we're really excited to just keep continuing going where this is going.
I will say a few things. The books that we sent over arrived, and I even felt silly looking at the books because we sent over like some of Dad's Tom Clancy books. And I'm like, what were we thinking? Sending these, you know what I mean? Like,
send some music books.
Yeah. But and you think that's going to be, but then you actually, it is different when you are standing there. mm-hmm. and you are looking around and you acknowledge they really do need books that are going to further their education. That's what they're asking for, is math books and science books and reading books. They want that. They are hungry. They are starving for that education. And, you know, I noticed that even when we presented for the medical school and the dental conference with Dr. Lee, that their first question to me was not raising their hand and saying, how do I get my CE credit for this course? Mm-hmm. That was not what they were concerned about. They wanted to know, how do I do this? How can I incorporate more of that? How can I bring this in? How can I bring that in? And it was absolutely amazing to see how thrilled they were that Americans from a developed country with their education wanted to come and serve and support in a small way. The production they put together for us, the lunch that we had with the faculty, the beautiful baskets they wove for us and gave us as gifts, because that's all they could do. They gave what they could, which was a ceremonial dance and
which was amazing.
And and food. And again, this is an underdeveloped country, but they cooked for us. I mean, it was absolutely amazing. And Kim, I remember I was sitting next to you and I'm just like, oh, here we go. So next year, when are we going to be back? You know what I mean? I got bit by the bug. You know what I mean? Not bit by a malaria infested mosquito. Thank you very much. But I did get bit by the bug. And so I know that this is the first of many experiences that we will have in Rwanda. And I'm so happy and grateful to be a part of all of that. So Kim, will you let us know, for anybody listening, as we wrap up today, for anybody who's listening, who has an interest in getting involved and wants to do humanitarian work, whether that's clinical, whether that is, you know, donating books, how can we get involved? How can we help? How can we serve?
Well, I think one of the first things is if you want to find out a little bit more, there's a really nice movie. It might be on Netflix. I'm not sure if it's that or Prime Video, but it's called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. And it's about a boy in a village, and I think it was Malawi, who had access to some books. And it gives you an idea of the book famine in Africa and how we just need books to learn things. And he was able to save a village by starting a windmill and learning how electricity worked. So that would be a good one to look at. And of course, Hotel Rwanda would be a good one to get an idea about the genocide. But they can go to Books for Africa, booksforafrica.com, and donate books. If you have someone that has passed away and want a memorial library, you can go through through the Eric Harms Memorial Libraries and donate a special library to Rwanda, just as you did. And if they have a question about getting involved, I can connect them to Dr. Lee and some other people in Rwanda, some medical providers as well. And you can just contact me at Dr. Kim, DRKIM, at Pine, PINE, Lake, LAKE, lawfirm.com. And I will help you get connected in any way I can.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Thank you so much. Not just for taking your time today to share with our listeners about all of the amazing work you're doing, but thank you for your inspiration. I think we can all agree that, you know, while we certainly don't want the tragedies that have happened in our lives to have been the reason why we've all connected, and I'd do anything in the world to bring my family back, and I know you would do the same, that there are more things that connect us than divide us. And I think there's a beautiful lesson in all of that. So thank you for sharing your time today. Thank you, Dr. Sanders, for joining us. And thank all of you for joining us. Another episode of Floss and Flip Flops. Thank you for joining us this month, and join us next month as we continue to brush up on fun oral systemic content.
We promise to keep you on your toes.
Thank you for joining us for another monthly episode of Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters.
Thank you for being part of the change we need to see in the medical and dental professions.
Join us next month for another sister-to-sister chat about other unique, interesting, and perhaps provocative and disruptive health topics.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, and maybe even leave a fabulous review.
And we'll catch you next month for another episode of
Floss and Flip Flops
with the Sanders Sisters.
I love you, Kinka.
I love you, Izzy.